learning new things, we have to remember that it's going to be difficult at first, but that doesn't mean that that should stop you from wanting to learn something new. So if you look at any of these virtues that I write about and you think, oh man, like this is way too much. Like there's no way that I could figure this out. Well, just remember that everything that you've ever learned in your life has gone through this process. It doesn't matter what it is.
This is Nick Kemp with the Ikigai Podcast, Japanese wisdom for a fulfilling and meaningful life. Find your Ikigai at ikigaitribe.com. This is Nick Kemp with the Ikigai Podcast. My guest today on episode 46 is Steve Beauchamp. Steve is a good friend of mine and a fellow Ikigai Tribe coach. Steve, you are an author, lover of nature, Lean Six Sigma Master Black Belt, and a continuous improvement mentor and practitioner. Your coaching practice aims to help overwhelmed leaders to stop being productivity junkies and discover work-life harmony through Japanese wisdom and philosophy. Thanks for joining me today, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really honored to be here with you today. So, yeah.
Well, likewise, it's an honor to have you on. And it's also an honor and privilege to celebrate your book, which we'll talk about, Always Improving, Lessons from the Samurai. So we'll discuss that in a minute. So, yeah, you've just released this book, Always Improving, Lessons from the Samurai, Create Work-Life Harmony Using the Eight Virtues of the Bushido Code. And yeah, congratulations, mate. It takes a lot of work to write a book. Yeah. We've actually both released a book pretty much this month or last month.
Mm-hmm.
And we're beginning to discover it takes a lot of work to market it. So how's it been going? How's the feedback?
So far, the book sales have been, you know, a steady trickle. I'm not social media giant, so I don't have this, you know, a massive following of people, but for the most part, the community that I am a part of has been supporting me, which has been really great. And you're right, the marketing side is definitely a little bit to navigate, but learning every day, you know, I'm looking for opportunities to improve upon my understanding of that. And, you know, I think the interesting thing about writing a book, and we share this, is that when I was going through school, I struggled with English class. I almost failed every single one that I took, barely passed the papers that I submitted. In fact, a lot of times I had to submit them twice because the first time around, the teacher was like, nope. And so, you know, it's just been a big identity shift for me to call myself an author. And so I think that's been one of the biggest struggles and obstacles for me to overcome, is like thinking of myself that way. So it's really been like an internal thing that I've been going through, but, you know, starting to normalize a little bit more for me. And, you know, the feedback that I've been getting from people that have read the book, I think has really been helping with that, because I've been getting a lot of positive feedback and a lot of just great encouragement from the people that have read it. So, yeah. So far, it's going well.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to this. It's almost like the imposter syndrome as,
right. Yeah.
You know, am I an author? And I can relate to, yeah, very painful memories of English at school and failing or just scraping through and having to take extra English as a subject. And thinking, I just hated it. And now to be like you're having written a book and spending quite a bit of time writing now, yeah, you sort of question, you know, am I worthy or.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it is an internal challenge. But, yeah, I think when you do write, you express your true self, and I think you've done that in your book, and you share these personal stories, and I love how you tied in, you know, your understanding of Japanese wisdom and these ideas of the samurai and these virtues into a really practical framework, and we'll get into that. Because I've always thought, the samurai, these are, it's almost mythical. I mean, it's not, clearly it's not, but the way we read about the samurai or understand them, I think it's quite hard to think about how can we apply this into daily life, and you've managed to do that with the book. So that's what I really liked about it, and also these fairly, you know, humble stories you share about your life. They're not dramatic, you know, life-changing stories, but they're these significant, meaningful moments in your life that you share. So I really enjoyed those stories.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks.
So I guess one important question we both probably thought about is who did you write the book for?
Yeah. I've read, you know, lots of different things about, you know, when you're writing, you should be thinking that you're writing to someone in particular. And so I really took that to heart. And when I wrote the book, I wrote it in a way that it kind of feels like a conversation. And it's like, you know, if I was to sit down with somebody on the other side of the table and sharing a pint together, or, you know, sharing a cup of coffee or tea and just like talking about these different topics is kind of how I approached it. And I approached it from the perspective of, if I had the opportunity to sit down with my younger self when I was first getting into project management and being a leader, these are some of the things that I wish somebody would have sat down and talked to me about. And although I've had, you know, different mentors in my life, I never really had one in the business world that I could spend a lot of time with and talk to. And so, because they kind of just came and go out of my life, or came and went rather, out of my life. So this is for my younger self, but also thinking about like different quality and project management professionals that are out there that may struggle with finding the harmony between the work that we do and then the personal life that we try to lead.
Yeah, I think a lot of people struggle with that, myself included.
Sure.
So let's go to the introduction of your book. You share a transformational experience you had in 2002 on September 15th. And in 8 seconds, your life was, I guess, redefined. Would you like to share what happened?
Yeah. This was when I was in my 20s, early 20s. I was working for a bank, and I was in my branch manager's office for a conference call. And I was operating as like a personal banker at the time. And so all the personal bankers in the branch were all in the office on this conference call. And, you know, we were just sitting there going about our business. And I felt the air pressure in the room change. Like when a door opens really fast, you can kind of feel and like sense that air pressure has like shifted. And I felt that. And then the next thing I knew, our security guard was yelling, you know, drop the gun. And about a second after that, 3 shots rang out. And everything from there on is kind of a blur. But I do remember diving over the desk, huddling under the desk with a coworker. And we all had panic buttons, you know, that we had in our offices. And so we all knew where each other's panic button was. And so we immediately pushed the panic button and ripped the phone off the desk and dialed 911. And probably in about 30 to 60 seconds, the parking lot was like full of police cars, ambulances, FBI. I mean, you name it, they were there. And I think when we had the opportunity to talk with everybody afterward, you know, we realized that that whole incident from start to finish, from the moment the door opened until the moment that the gentleman was, you know, laying dead on the floor of the lobby, was 8 seconds.
Wow.
And those 8 seconds changed the course of my life, because from that moment, I really couldn't go back to work. I was always, you know, I had this thing in the back of my mind where I was just, you know, I just struggled to be in that place. And then I never really dealt with the PTSD from it for a long time. So much so that I would actually go to restaurants and I couldn't sit in the middle of a restaurant. I would have to sit either in the corner or somewhere where I could have my back to the wall so that I could see the room.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's crazy how 8 seconds can change your life for quite some time.
Hey there, Nick Kemp here, and I wanted to touch base and let you know about my new course, the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. If you are interested in learning more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com. Now back to the episode. That is traumatic. So I kind of failed to say that at the beginning. I said these humble stories, but there is this one significant story you share.
Yeah.
And actually, I worked as a bank teller, and I thought, you know, customers being abusive was traumatic. And I mean, I left because of that. But your experience, clearly, I'm sure it still plays on your mind now from time to time. And
yeah, well, I sought, you know, some counseling and worked with a really great therapist to help me unpack that and learn from my experience. And, you know, I still think about it, but I think about it in a much different context now. And, you know, I think for the longest time, I thought of myself as a victim of that situation. And because I thought of myself as a victim, I was applying a victim mentality to it. And so once I started working through it and realizing that although it was a really terrible situation that could have gone, you know, a very different way, because no one of our staff was injured at all in the course of the events. Which, you know, very thankful for. It's unfortunate that the gentleman had to have the outcome that he had. But I think, and I, you know, I don't want to minimize trauma because I don't think that that's fair to anybody. But I think the thing that I realized over time was I was able to choose how I wanted to perceive that situation moving forward. And when I started realizing that I had control over, you know, how I wanted that, you know, incident to show up for me, that was like really when I started shifting, you know, my decision making around it. So, yeah.
You actually state words to that effect. From that experience and years of reflection, you learnt, and I quote, "We always have control over our future and the decisions we are making." So, yeah, you've taken this one experience and I guess other life experience to realise, yeah, we can make good decisions or better decisions and we're not a victim. And the victim mentality is easy to fall into.
Yeah.
Constantly dealing with problems and troubles that are often, or we often feel aren't our own.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you discovered you can integrate Bushido and continuous improvement principles to take control of your time and life direction. And that's what we're going to talk about today on this episode. And this is what I like about your book. You're presenting these Bushido wisdom into, I guess, not only work with continuous improvement, but also you apply it to personal life. So let's address that now. We often hear the phrase work-life balance, but you write and titled your book Work-Life Harmony. Is there a difference?
For me, there is. I think the interesting thing about words, I think all words are important and the words that you use are very important. And I think, you know, the context of words is really important, which is what I really love about the Japanese language in and of itself as a side note. But the thing for me about like work-life balance gives me kind of a mental picture of a scale, right? Mm-hmm. And you have like two sides, and you have your work and then you have your personal life on the other side. And you're constantly trying to find that balancing point of the two sides of the scale, right? And you take something off one side and the other side gets lopsided. Yeah. And so you try to like, it's a never ending game of trying to balance the two. And so I prefer the term work-life harmony, which for me, I get a picture of like, I think the best way to describe it is like music. So I'm a musician. I've played musical instruments most of my life, as you have. And so when I think about a chord in music, it can show up in a lot of different ways, right? You have major chords, minor chords, you have diminished chords, you have augmented chords, you have all these different types of ways that music shows up. Some of them sound really pleasant to the ears, some of them not so pleasant to the ears, but they invoke an emotion that comes with the sound. And so when I think of work-life harmony, there's going to be times where I have these like perfectly resonating chords that just sound so pleasing to the ear, right? It's like everything is just like sunshine and lollipops. Everybody's happy, right? So you have like that kind of feeling that can be evoked from that blending of the two. And then you also have moments where it may not be super perfect. There may be some times where the harmony isn't as perfect as you want it to be necessarily. But it's, for me, that's kind of where I see the difference. And when I think about work-life harmony, it's all about trying to work in such a way that I can truly live, right? I don't live to work, right? When I'm not working, I'm not working. Like, I don't check my email. I don't respond to email. I don't, you know, do any work that's related to that at all. Like, mm-hmm. I compartmentalize that really well. And that's probably because I got burnt out along the way. And I write about that in the book too, right? But it's like, I think for me, that's where the big difference lies in my mind, is it's finding those activities that can fit together in such a way that creates that resonance that, you know, really connects to your authenticity. And, you know, and this is kind of where it connects to Ikigai for me, because it's about, first, you need to know who you are, though, in order to understand what that resonance is. And so you first go down that road of discovery of, well, who am I really at my core? And what are my core values? And how do they show up for me? And then you use that to really figure out, what does this work-life harmony mean to me? And how can I choose to do activities that create more of that harmony in my life, rather than choosing to do activities that, you know, pull away from that harmony.
I love it. I love the chord analogy, and life can feel like music. We, if we're in a good rhythm, we're sort of in a nice, maybe we're in a nice sort of rock song. And then when we want to relax, you know, mm-hmm. we can right. listen to maybe some folk music or some nice calming classical music. But yeah, harmony is something I've really learned to appreciate from my life in Japan. Mm-hmm. And as you know, there are many words that describe harmony. And so getting this harmony in life, I think's a better approach to sort of, yeah, having this idea that there are two things and they need to be perfectly balanced, which can't really happen. But we can find this harmony and adapt to it. And that refers, or we can refer to the cover of your book. Mm-hmm. So what is this kanji character we're looking at?
Yeah, so that is the character for wa. And wa is often interpreted as harmony. But I did a little bit of deeper digging to kind of learn a little bit more about it. And I found that it can also point toward finding peace and acceptance of just of like what's happening around you. And so it's about just finding that harmony with the world around you. Again, there's just so much more under the surface sometimes if you dig just a little bit deeper. And I found that to be just a really beautiful way to think about, like, well, what does harmony really mean? And so that's why I felt it made good sense to have it on the cover of my book.
It is a beautiful character, and it does make sense. And I think that's what we're all striving for, really, is finding this harmony in life where we are being authentic and comfortable. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, these harmonious relationships with people, but to our work, to our hobbies. And it's not easy.
No.
Yeah, maybe these virtues you speak of and write about can help us. And so that leads us to Bushido. So we should touch on the meaning of Bushido. Yeah, what is a literal translation?
So back in 1899, so over 120 years ago, Inazo Nitobe wrote the book Bushido. And he wrote that Bushido literally translates to military knight ways, which in the English, you know, can sound a little clunky. And so he goes on to say, it sounds pretty clunky, but he goes on to say, it's like, you could also think of it in a context of the ways in which the fighting nobles should observe in just their daily lives and their vocation. And so you could think about it as like the guidelines, if you will, for the knighthood. So a way for them to behave.
Yeah, well, that goes back to Do, which is often attached to many Japanese crafts or arts or martial arts, and this idea of a set of practices, or, you know, or the way to do things. So it's often referred to as, you know, the way of the warrior in, I guess, a Western context. Yeah, what are your thoughts on that? Do you also see it as the way of the warrior, or is that a sort of a romanticization or misinterpretation?
I mean, I think you could certainly look at it in that context, but I think the thing that most people gloss over, because, you know, we had talked a little bit at the beginning how often samurai are depicted in like movies or things as just like, you know, these guys that just ran around with swords on their belts, right? And there's so much more than that. You know, they often had very like a strong devotion to a hobby like calligraphy or poetry or the tea ceremony.
Yeah.
And even some of them would spend time learning the art of bonsai. And so they have all of these different creative elements that made up who they were, not just running around, you know, getting into war with people. So if you think about the context of the way of the warrior as the warrior being a whole person and not just a soldier, then yeah, I think that you could think about it that way. It's important to recognize, though, that these warriors were very prolific in other areas of their lives, not just sword craft or archery or other armaments for that matter. But yeah.
Well, that leads to, I guess, these virtues, these eight virtues you write about, and you dedicate a chapter to each, and we'll look at some of them. But I'd like to quote you from the book. Mm. All of these virtues could be thought of as interlocking, much like a piece of samurai armor is constructed. It's very difficult to have one of them without the other seven. Reason being, as you'll discover throughout the rest of this book, all eight of them work in unity with each other. Yeah, so that actually reminds me of the seven ikigai needs of Miko Kamiya, and how they do relate to each other, and it would be very helpful to have all seven. And so likewise, I think having all eight of these virtues would be helpful. And you were really creative in your way of representing them. And you came up with something I'm not really familiar with. I'll just find it on the page here. You decided to create a come on to articulate them or have a reference or a framework. And I guess we should also touch on the kanji in the center. So we'll do that after you tell me what a come on is.
Sure. So in my research of the samurai, I came across the kamon, which is a family or clan crest. It was unique to each clan. And actually, it was considered very disrespectful to use somebody else's for your own. And really, it's a visual representation of, it's like a graphic, if you will, that kind of helps describe who you are. Some of them would have kanji characters on them. Some of them would be just flowers or other types of designs. And it actually started out way back in the Heian period. And just a couple of samurai started marking some of their personal items in a certain way so that they could, you know, say, well, this is mine and that's yours. And it was just, they started out with just a few of them doing that. And then it started to become a thing. And by the end of the period where, you know, full on war was common, every single samurai clan would have a kamon on the banners and the flags that they would wave and bring into battle. And so when you saw that design, you knew exactly who those people were. And even so much so it became emblems that they put onto their armor so that you would be able to tell who each other were in battle. And it was just a way to be able to signify who you were. And it became this way to share with everyone else who you were. And then your reputation, right, would precede that graphic, basically, so that whenever people saw it, they knew, like, who you were, basically. And so I decided that I thought that was a really interesting way to share with the world what I'm all about. And when I think about the path that I've been on, these eight virtues have really been present for me on my journey that I've been on for the last, you know, last decade and a bit of my life. And so the, you know, the center of the kamon, which if you look at it, you notice that it looks like one of the characters matches the cover, which is true, but the word that represents is choa. And choa is something that you could think of as your search for harmony and peace. It's like the journey that you're on towards looking for finding the peace that you're seeking. And so for me, the way that I find that is, you know, through the eight petals of the flower.
Yeah, I also have the impression it's more, it's like a more personal or self-peace. Yeah, so that was interesting. I thought that was really smart. Instead of, you know, maybe the logical thing to do would have been to have Bushido or samurai in the center. But this idea to find, I guess, your authentic self and harmony with yourself, yeah, it made sense to me. And that you can use these virtues as a way to do that. Now, we should touch on Kaizen because you do relate the two and that's how you apply them effectively in the book for, I guess, a modern world.
Yeah.
And some of our audience, I think most of our audience would be familiar with the word Kaizen, but let's discuss it because it's, we might have two ways to think about it, which you write about. So what is Kaizen?
So commonly, Kaizen is interpreted in the Western world as continuous improvement. So in most circles, when people hear that word, that's immediately what comes to mind for them, which isn't necessarily wrong. However, I have spent a little bit more time researching this. I also had a mentor that was from Japan that came over to Seattle and worked with us for a few different visits. And his name was Sensei Nakao. And the way that he put it, I loved so much that I've never forgotten it. And he liked to talk about it as change for the better. And he went on even further to help explain what he meant by that. And if you think about, you know, your house, and if your kitchen or your bathroom needs remodeling, you're going to have to completely destroy it before you can rebuild it. And so he used that analogy to kind of help us understand that sometimes you're going to have to completely dismantle a process and then put it back together to be something that's better. So sometimes that change isn't just building upon what's already there. Sometimes you have to completely, you know, dismantle things and rebuild it so that it's better. And so it's not just, so that's why I think continuous improvement sometimes can mislead a little bit in like what the actual interpretation of the word means. So it's just, again, the nerd in me wanted to dig a little bit deeper into what that word really means and what it means to us and how we can make that more personal for us. Because I think Kaizen isn't just about business. It's about the individual as well. And we all are going through our own transformation, you know, on a continual basis. And so I think it's important to realize that sometimes the parts of us that we've, you know, grown accustomed to, you know, might be like our bathroom or kitchen that we're going to remodel. And we need to completely dismantle parts of us and rebuild so that we can, you know, become better and more in line with who we really are and our authentic selves, right?
That is something I really appreciated about the book. And like you, yeah, researching these concepts and giving them respect and the time to understand them, I think is important. So I like how you've done that. You've done that, I mean, a lot, because I know who you are. We're good friends and we've explored some of these concepts together, and I've learned a lot from your book. And yeah, I actually did talk to another guest about Sensei Nakao, Bob Emiliani, and yeah, it's amazing one person can have all this incredible wisdom, but also be quite willing to share it with, it seemed like he was willing to share it with anyone who wanted to learn.
Yeah, if you were open, he was happy to share, but you had to recognize that that required you to stop talking, which is really tough in the Western world, right? We want to keep talking all the time. And so yeah, I always really enjoyed any time I had the opportunity to be a part of his visits.
Well, I'll ask a question and stop talking. And this probably goes back to your ideal reader, a quality and project management professional. So related to this idea of Kaizen, you have 7 main weapons of continuous improvement. So what are these weapons?
Yeah, just a little backstory on them. So Taichi Ono, who, you know, used to mentor a lot of the leaders and engineers at Toyota, came up with these. So these aren't mine. These are his. And the reason why there's 7 is kind of an arbitrary reason. So he was a really big fan of a samurai by the name of Benkei. And Benkei used to carry 7 weapons with him anytime he was out traveling outside the safety of his like village. And so it's actually really arbitrary that he chose 7. It was just for that reason, as far as I can tell. But anyway, so the 7 that he would mentor everyone to learn how to master, because he believed that if you could master these 7 tools, that you could be ready for anything that would come your way from a business perspective. Just like if you had those 7 weapons that Benkei carried, you would be ready for any conflict that would come your way. So that's kind of the context behind it. So the first one is check sheets or tally sheets. These are typically used to just keep track of what's happening. So like an occurrence of a failure, or, you know, an occurrence of something happening, right? So it's just basically, think like when you're like just tally marks, that's kind of like a way to think about it. Then there's the Pareto chart, which is based on the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule as it's known. And these are used to categorize either incidents or failures or whatever into natural groupings. And typically you can use this to determine where 80% of your problem is coming from based on how the graph is laid out. And I have an example in the book. It's hard to kind of describe without visual aids, but basically think about a descending bar chart and then a line graph that is a cumulative percentage that are working in conjunction on two different axes. And the idea is that 80% of your problems typically comes from 20% of the causes. The Ishikawa diagram is also known as a fishbone diagram. It's named after Keru Ishikawa, who also worked for Toyota. It's used to help sort out potential causes of a problem into more likely causes of the problem and the effect that you're seeing. So it's typically grouped into six categories, and those categories are, you know, they can move around depending on who comes up with the categories. And honestly, the categories aren't like super critical in using it, but it's really meant to help you group things together so you can start seeing a natural affinity of what's going on with those particular causes. Then there's a control chart.
Yep.
A control chart is also something that's called a run chart. It basically plots data points along a timeline. So you have your time going along the bottom, and then your value along the y-axis, and you just plot your data points along, and it just shows the natural process shift and drift as it goes. Then you have a scatter plot. A scatter plot is used to determine if there's a relationship between two different variables. And it's really one variable's on one axis and another variable's on the other axis. Doesn't really matter which way you put it. But basically, as you plot all of the points, it'll start helping you see how strong of a relationship there is between the two points. So there can be a very positive relationship. So as one gets better, so does the other one. You can also have a negative relationship. As one gets better, the other one gets worse. And then you can have no relationship, or the data points are just all over the place. And it just kind of looks like you shot at it with a shotgun. Or you could have, you know, a relationship where things will kind of get better as something else gets better. And then at a certain point, it stops, and then it starts getting worse. So It's kind of a way to kind of see how they're connected to each other. Then you have a stratification plot, which is used in a similar way as a scatter, except you're taking naturally occurring groups of data to see if they are consistently performing the same way. So to be able to see if these natural groupings of data are behaving the same way across the whole spectrum, or if there's one particular group that's standing out as either really great or really not great, so that you can go learn from it. And then the final one is a histogram, which groups data into natural categories to see if there's any kind of trend or natural balance that's there. So
there you go. Well, I'm pretty familiar with one of the seven weapons, the 80-20 principle. And I know a lot of businessmen refer to that. And it's not just problems, that's often applied to, you know, wealth or profits, or positive results come from, you know, 20% of the work you do.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be verified and something valued. And I probably need to look at it more for my own business and own life, the 80-20 principle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something also really effective, and it could be another weapon, is the values in action survey that we both use in our business and we've used for personal, I guess, growth and development. Mm-hmm. And I found this really helpful that you recommend the reader to take the values in action survey. And then for each virtue you go through, you associate certain values to that virtue in each chapter. Now, I'm really familiar with the values in action survey. And as you know, I also use it, but maybe our audience doesn't know what it is. So would you like to explain what it is?
Sure. So in a basic sense, it's a really wonderful tool. I agree that you actually introduced me to. And so that's why once I learned about it, I've been using it constantly with everybody that I work with. And basically, it's a very simple survey that helps you understand what are your most prominent core values and strengths. And they have determined that there's 24 key, you know, character core values and strengths that kind of make up everybody. And we all have some degree of these showing up in our lives. And as you go through the survey and you go through the different questions and you answer these different questions in certain ways, it helps shape, you know, which ones are more prominent for you and which ones show up more easily for you in your life. And I think the interesting thing about this particular tool is whenever you talk about core values with people, the first reaction that people usually have is, oh yeah, I know what those are.
Yeah.
Right? Like we always have that kind of reaction of like, oh yeah, I know what my core values are. Because I actually had the same feeling when I was taking that for the first time. I was like, oh, I already know what this is. But then after I got the results, I was actually quite surprised to see some of them show up in my top 10, which I was like pleasantly surprised at. And I was like, oh, I never really thought about how I showed up in that way. And that really like connected and resonated for me and really helped me understand more of who my authentic self really was and is. And so you could also think about the opposite end of those 24 as, you know, if you were of the mindset that you wanted to look for opportunities for improvement, you could look at some of the ones on the bottom and you could think about, well, how could I, you know, show up a little bit differently if that's your flavor? My personal preference is to really focus on your strengths and understand how to use your strengths so that you can work with others who have those strengths that you don't. So, yeah, but that's kind of in a nutshell what it is without going into a long drawn out explanation.
Well, what I like about it, I guess from the Ikigai angle, is it's backed up by positive psychology. Mm-hmm. And I love this idea that it's values in action, suggesting you're actioning these values, you're expressing them. And they can also be these values you try to live up to. So that's why I think it's a really effective tool, because we often, just kind of select these values from a larger list. But their tool's quite, I think it's accurate and effective. And it's interesting, the premise is interesting that there are 24 different core value strengths. And to some degree, we have all of them. Mm-hmm. And so it suggests that we can look at the ones maybe we'd like to cultivate or that we value, but we know we don't always express and think, how can I be more respectful or how can I live with more integrity? And I think I think it's a really effective tool and the one I recommend. And there are many. The great thing about this one is it's free as well. So if you're interested, if the listener's interested, they can go just Google VIA survey. Mm-hmm. And that leads us to your companion workbook, which I thought was a really great idea and printed it out. So I've got to spend time to do all this. Mm-hmm. But you have a workbook that you encourage the reader to print out and use as they go through the book. And I think that's a smart idea. I've done the same for my workbook.
Yeah.
So let's dive into some of these eight virtues, Steve. And before we do that, I think we should look at two names you often refer to. You've actually mentioned one, so Inazo Nitobe.
Mm-hmm.
But who was Musashi Miyamoto?
So he originally wrote the Book of Five Rings like 400 years ago or so. And the Book of Five Rings is basically a kind of like a manual for the warrior class, basically, of the time. And it was written in a way to help them understand and capture the learning and the teaching that was happening so that it wouldn't just go away when somebody passed, right? So it was meant to capture the essence of the teaching. So it was written from his perspective. And I really appreciate a lot of the things that he wrote in that book and in some of the other things he wrote. You know, he was also the author of the Dokudo, which is, you know, the art of walking alone, which made up of 21 principles. But we don't have time to dig into all of those today.
That's
a whole other conversation. But yeah, that's who he was. And I just really appreciated his insight. And as I was just learning about the culture of the samurai, it just seemed appropriate to include some of his quotes.
Cool. So we could think of Miyamoto as a philosopher and maybe Nitobe as a scholar?
Yeah. I mean, Miyamoto, he was also a very successful warrior. He knew his sword craft very well. And actually, if I remember right, I think he was undefeated in all of the duels that he was in. In addition to the duels that he had, like one-on-one, he was in many battles and, you know, was not mortally wounded from any of them. And in fact, he passed away in solitude while he was writing, if I remember right. And so he was quite the prolific warrior and philosopher of the time, for sure, yeah.
Well, let's dive into these virtues then. And the first one is Gi, which is justice. And you talk a lot about equity under the theme of justice.
Mm-hmm.
So would you like to touch on this?
Yeah. So I thought it was important to focus a little bit on equity. This is something that's very important to me and something that I always like to think about in the work that I do is how can I think about things from an equity lens? And I think it's probably helpful to first define equity, because a lot of people think about equality and equity as being the same thing, but it really isn't. So the big difference between the two, equality is all about treating people the same way, right? And I think we all kind of understand what that means. But equity, on the other hand, is providing opportunity so that everyone has equal outcomes, no matter where they're starting from, right? So, I mean, I think that we all know that in this world, or at least I hope we all know, in this world that we're not all starting from the same point, right? We all have different starting points. And so looking at things through the lens of equity is how can I think about this in terms of like getting an equal outcome for everyone that's involved. And so when I think about that, and I think about how do I apply that lens to the work that I do. So this is about thinking through, like particularly for me and the work that I do is focused a lot on process. And so it's how can we think about creating processes that have equitable outcomes for the people that are engaged in the work and also the people that those processes serve, right? Because there's internal and external customers all over the place. And then there's also the people that are actually part of the process. And so So I think, yeah, so that when I think about equity and justice from a context of project management, that's kind of where I really like to lean in.
I'm glad you did lean into that. I really like that idea of recognizing equity in this context of justice. And you're right, people, we're not all starting from the same playing field. Some of us are advantaged in some ways and others are disadvantaged, and recognizing that and then helping people get to where they want to go, I think is a form of justice. And to quote Musashi, I guess related to this idea, and I love this quote you identified, truth is not what you want it to be, it is what it is. You must bend to its power or live a lie. I think that's right. And yeah, the last thing I ever want to do is live a lie. So this idea of, yeah, truth, and I guess kind of relates to accepting the true nature of things. One of my favorite words we talk about is arugamama.
Yeah, and I think when you understand the truth of, like what we were just talking about, that we're all starting from different places, and you have to come to grips with that before you have the opportunity to actually allow equity to come through. Like you have to come to grips with the fact that what the truth really means. Like for me personally, that meant me recognizing that as a white straight male, I have probably the most privilege in the entire world over anybody else. And that was a humbling thing for me to come to grips with and realize that, okay, I've been given so much just because of the way that I look. Understanding that truth is really important. And whatever other truth that you're trying to like really get to the bottom of, I think that's a really great starting point.
Well, I think you highlight that truth, and I would like to quote you on this occasion from the book. Justice was and is a core virtue of the samurai because it highlighted the importance of fairness and having an upstanding moral character. And that's something I think you have and you strive to maintain. And it's something, yeah, I aspire to achieve and maintain this idea of, yeah, what is your moral character? And, you know, this idea of fairness. Yeah, so I really reflected on this idea. Wow, Steve's gone on a really different perspective I've probably never thought about in terms of justice, this idea of equity. And, you know, you apply that in a professional and personal context, and you write a story on this, but I'm thinking we might leave that story for the reader to explore, and we might move on to another virtue.
Sure.
That's, again, all these virtues are interconnected and relatable. And so the next one is Yuki. So what's Yuki?
Yeah, that is courage.
So something we need in this day and age. And a quote again from Musashi is, it seems difficult at first because everything is difficult. Yeah. And you quote, it takes courage to want to learn new things, to say things that need to be said, and to stand up for something you believe in. We all have a fear of failing. This resonated to me. So, would you like to share your thoughts on maybe, yeah, both these quotes?
Yeah. So I think when I came across his quote, I was just, I mean, that really resonated for me because, you know, I've spent the greater part of my career as a trainer and training people on different things, or a mentor and coach, right? And so the idea that somebody could say, well, this is just too hard, right? Well, it's like, well, everything is hard at first, right? And and you have to like recognize that there's a process you go through of learning that helps things become less difficult over time. And I talk about in the book the four stages of learning. And real quick, you know, the first stage is you are unconsciously incompetent, right? Like you just don't know what you don't know. And then when you start learning, you start picking up a little bit Now you become consciously incompetent, where you know how much you don't know. From there, you transition into stage three, which is you become consciously competent, where you feel like you know some things, you feel like you have some success that's starting to happen. And then finally, you move into what's called unconscious competence, where you actually don't know how much you actually know. And you've actually probably like forgotten more than the person that's starting out, right? Because, yeah, you just become just so easily flowing through whatever it is you're doing that it just comes naturally to you. But before you get to that stage, you had to go through all of the other stages of learning where, you know, you forget how difficult things were at first. And so I think when it comes to learning new things, we have to remember that it's going to be difficult at first, but that doesn't mean that that should stop you from wanting to learn something new. So if you look at any of these virtues that I write about and you think, oh man, like this is way too much. Like there's no way that I could figure this out. Well, just remember that everything that you've ever learned in your life has gone through this process. It doesn't matter what it is, right?
This actually reminds me of two things, how once we do reach that final stage, then we're at risk of the curse of knowledge.
Mm.
And I'd probably go through this all the time. I just assume everyone knows what, you know, Ikigai is, and mm-hmm. most people don't know what it is. And then this idea from Ken Moggi of starting small, and that if something is difficult or seems difficult, we can only really start small.
Mm-hmm.
But the amazing benefit of trying new things and doing difficult things is life-changing. And it really does open your world up to opportunities and things you never thought you'd do. And I think both of us would agree that we probably never thought we'd write a book.
No.
And here we are, you know, talking about our books. So yeah. it is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everything's pretty much difficult for the first time.
Yeah. And I think the other thing too is like once you get to that point of unconscious competence and you then move into a journey of mentoring someone else, now you've started that whole cycle all over again because now you're learning how to be a mentor. And you're learning how to teach the things that you learned throughout this process. And at first, it's going to be difficult, right? And so anytime you go back around that loop, there's going to be a new process that you're learning through. And I think this, to me, highlights the importance of just approaching things with curiosity and that idea of, you know, the... And I talk about this in a different chapter, but the idea of like a beginner's mind, the you know, yeah. Shoshin, right? So really having that curiosity of and the newness of everything that you're seeing around you and what can I learn from this and how can I, you know, take this to like the next stage of my own learning. So.
No, we'll touch on that virtue where we include, yeah, this idea of Shoshin, which I love too, and mm-hmm. which I encourage everyone who takes, you know, my program or reads my book to forget everything you've learned about Ikigai and sort of begin with a beginner's mind.
Mm-hmm.
But something you also relate to courage is difficult, having difficult conversations mm-hmm. and having the courage to have them. And yeah, I do not like having difficult conversations. I've actually had quite a few conversations with you saying, oh, no, I'm in this situation, Steve. I've got to talk to someone and I really don't want to.
Yeah.
And you've helped me get through those tough times. And, yeah, why do we need courage? I mean, when you think about courage, most people probably wouldn't think about having difficult conversations. But when they're faced with one, boy... Do they need courage? Yeah, so how were you able to identify this virtue with having difficult conversations?
You know, when I think about courage and I think about difficult conversation and just the things that come up for us. I think about it in terms of, you know, this idea of, well, you start getting into your own head about, well, how's this other person going to like feel when I say these things? And you start getting in your own way. You start, you know, I think really creating a narrative for yourself that's not true, because you haven't even had the conversation yet. And you've created this whole backstory of what's going to happen. And I think having the courage to push past that and to just have the difficult conversation, I think really kind of connects to the idea of managerial courage, of being able to be vulnerable and being able to step into those conversations, even though you know that it's going to be hard, right? But again, everything might seem difficult at first, right? Because it is. So it'll get better though, right? And you have to just step into it and allow. It's kind of like getting, like if you've ever put a body part into a really cold, like river or lake or something like that. Like at first it's super cold, right? You're just like, oh my God, this is super cold. And then you put it back in a couple of seconds later, you're like, oh, okay, it's not as cold. And you start to acclimate to how it feels. And I think that's the same way with this, right? Like the more you do it and the more you lean into it, I think the easier it becomes.
Well, interesting. I had a cold shower this morning and I have this, it's like a challenge. I think I'll stay in the cold water until it's comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, every time you shift your body underneath the shower, it sort of hits a new part and you react to it.
Yeah.
But within a few seconds, you adjust. And after the shower, you feel great. You know, you feel alive. And perhaps after we overcome these difficult conversations, we think we feel a lot better. We resolve the issue. We realize there's a misunderstanding, or that we can either understand each other and move on. And having these difficult conversations with others involves another virtue, and that is gin. So what's gin, apart from a new drink I'm enjoying recently?
That's a whole other conversation by itself too. So that is interpreted as compassion. Yeah. And you know, I think that for me, the reason why these two are so closely connected, and you can kind of see in how I wrote the chapters, how they flow to, there was almost like one chapter that I broke into two parts in a way, because I think you need to be able to have the courage to show compassion. Like if you don't have that courage, showing compassion is going to be very difficult. At least in my experience, it has been.
Yep. No, I I agree. And yeah, this is interesting. In your book, there are these parallels to Miyako Kamiya's work, who I like to think of, you know, the mother of Ikigai. And there's this quote from Nitobe, beneath the instinct to fight, there lurks a divine instinct to love. And so I think on this theme, you know, when we have these difficult situations or interpersonal problems, we have this sense of fear, which can turn on, I guess, a flight or fight mode. And I guess flight means avoidance. We don't want to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So we don't have the conversation. Or fight is, we blame the person, or we go above them or around them and blame them. So fear really seems to bring out the worst in us, and often brings out this desire to fight. Yet, as Nitobe identified, we do have this instinct to, I guess, to love or feel loved. And that's what Kamiya wrote about. Some people, Ikigai can be this dominance, and they want to dominate people because they develop a sense of power, and that becomes a source of Ikigai. And really underneath it all, they just want to be accepted and loved. And that can only come through, I guess, with this idea of, I guess, a shared compassion. So should we be turning fear, our fear, into compassion for either the people we're dealing with or for the situation or even for ourselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it becomes really difficult to really see the situation from all points of view when fear is present, right? Because you're only going to be thinking about you, right? It's like, what's in it for me right now? And it's all about me. If you can let go of that fear, you can start thinking about, well, what does this situation mean to the other person or the other people that are involved in it? And then you can start thinking about it from their perspective and from their context and realizing that, you know, I think the majority of the time, the way that people are reacting around us has nothing to do with us. And oftentimes we take it personally and then we respond and react from the way that we're receiving it because we're scared or we're operating out of that fear. And, you know, if we just realize that there's a high likelihood that the way that people are reacting and acting in front of you has nothing to do with you, you have a much easier time showing compassion to them and just really trying to understand, like, you know, how is this showing up for you and how can I help you, rather than why are you talking to me that way? Right. You shouldn't talk to me that way. You don't have a right to talk to me that way. And it goes on from there. Right. And so, and I've had plenty of instances where I've really royally screwed this up in my life. Like, I'm not trying to tell you that I've figured all this out perfectly, but I have had instances where I've seen these things play out, you know, on both sides of how to approach this. And I can tell you that this is how I strive to be. And for the most part, I get it right now, right? But in my past, not so much.
No, I can relate to that. I think fear drives us to delusion because we're so focused on the self and our what's going to happen to me. And yeah, you become delusional and think these things that aren't happening. Yeah, so that's interesting. And then with this idea of compassion, tied to that is another virtue, re. So what is re?
Yeah, so that's respect.
Yeah, this is definitely one virtue I deeply came to understand in Japan, respect for others, for objects, countless stories where I could talk about how Japanese have respect for others, objects, concepts. But something that surprised me in this chapter that you wrote on was this idea and importance of having pride and allowing others to feel pride in their work. How does this relate to respect?
You know, just thinking over my career of the different places I've worked and the people that I've worked with, I feel, you know, everybody wants to feel pride in what they do. I mean, I haven't met anybody that, you know, comes to work and doesn't have that, like, that desire, right, to want to feel that way. And if you don't give people the opportunity to do that, I think you're really not showing them any respect. Like, if you, you know, think that it's all about you and you don't have to, like, you know, realize where they're coming from, then what ends up happening is when people don't have the opportunity to have that connection, they show up in a way to not have any ownership of the work they're doing. They pass blame, or, you know, it turns into like the shame game also, right? Or, you know, justifying your behavior because, you know, somebody else is doing this or that. And it just creates an environment where nobody really has any pride in the work that they're doing. And it really just comes down to the blame, shame, and justification. And that creates an environment that the workers and the management team have a really hard time succeeding. And so, if you approach it from the perspective of, okay, how can we create an environment where everybody can feel pride in what they're doing? That in turn is showing respect for the whole organization and your team. So that's kind of the perspective that I took when I was looking at this.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, to share one personal story, I guess my last real job is where I had no sense of opportunity or sense of pride in the work I was doing. I was sort of the spot fire guy. Mm-hmm. Moved to one project to the other and just fix this, fix that, do that. And it was incredibly unfulfilling and soul-destroying work. And I was really depressed going into this job and eventually quit. And there were other issues. I mean, there was sheer lack of respect with the workplace bullying that was going around as well. But then this also reminds me of it's a little bit dark. It's just a form of punishment in Japan for some companies to, obviously, with employees they're not happy with, rather than fire them, they keep them on the payroll, have them come into work and just have them basically sit somewhere at the front of the office and have them do nothing all day. And I'm sure there's a word for it. And that's that's obviously clearly showing we don't respect you. Right. And we're going to put you through some form of punishment to remind you. So, yeah, that's not a healthy workplace practice.
Right.
Because that would lack a lot of integrity, which is probably a virtue I value. I value all of these virtues, but integrity seems to be something I really think about and want to, I guess, aspire to maintain in what I do. Mm. And that is, again, tied with all these other virtues and you write about, and that is makoto. So, yeah, integrity, to quote, being able to live with integrity is a crucial aspect of the Bushido Code. It is important to me because it shows others how I live my life and how I carry myself. So I'm quoting you there, Steve. And yeah, I love that. And that's sort of me in a nutshell. I really value integrity and think it's, you know, the one virtue you should strive to achieve in all areas of your life. Mm-hmm. So on this theme, again, you've got this unique angle at looking at integrity, and you share three Japanese concepts that are related to your state of mind that illustrate how to blend integrity into one's working life. So would you like to share them?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we talked a little bit about one of them already, and that was Shoshin, which is beginner's mind. And you can think about that as approaching situations as if you're seeing it for the first time. Even if it's something that you may have encountered that looks similar to it in the past, you always want to approach it from a fresh kind of perspective. So if you're living out this idea, the concept of like same shit, different day doesn't apply to you anymore, right? Because you because it's not the same. Everything is different, right? It's that unique opportunity to look at this from a completely fresh perspective, right? So that's what I think about when I think of Shoshin. The second one that I'll touch on is Mushin, which is translated or interpreted as mind of no mind, which I had to like dig a little deeper on that one, because I was like, what does that mean? So, and I really appreciated, you had a conversation with Rie Takeda about Mushin in context of Shodo. And that really, you know, resonated for me, because it's this idea that you can take action without thinking about it. Like you're just doing it. And if you think about what I already talked about with that four stages of learning, right? So that's that unconscious competence kind of idea where you're just able to act without really thinking about it, and it just happens. The third one is Zenshin, which is mind with no remainder. You could think about this as focused action or disciplined practice. You are very intentional with your attention span, so you're not allowing yourself to focus on anything else so that you can be really disciplined in the moment. And I think a really great way to think about how all of these things come together, I kind of used this example in the book too, of there were stories of samurai that could take a bow and arrow and hit a target in the pitch black dead of night. And I mean, I don't know how in the world you'd do that without like having that discipline practice and that idea of just letting go of the moment and just, you know, allowing yourself to realize that this is a fresh moment. And so anyway, so those are the three ways to cultivate your mindset so that you can learn new things with discipline. You can learn them so well that you can just do them without thinking, but then you're also approaching each situation as a fresh, new situation and not allowing yourself to get tripped up thinking, oh yeah, I know exactly how this is going to play out.
Yeah, I love these ideas. I mean, Mushin almost seems to be this heightened level of flow. Like we talk about flow, how we lose ourselves to flow and we often do our best work. Mm-hmm. And then Shoshin, you know, this beginner mind that I'd probably scoff at if I was my younger self and go, beginner mind, yeah, whatever. Mm. And now it's so powerful to approach things you think you know and think, well, hang on, mm-hmm. maybe I don't really know or fully understand. I'll start with a beginner's mind. So, Steve, it's been a real joy. We could certainly go through the other virtues, but I think we'll leave that to the reader.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a joy to have you on this podcast. You've become an important friend. I see you as someone I can turn to for advice and a mentor in some ways as well. So I really appreciate our friendship. And you were always going to come on to this podcast, and the book was this opportunity. So always improving, lessons from the samurai. Create work-life harmony using the eight virtues of the Bushido Code by Steve Beauchamp. Did I say it right this time?
It's Beauchamp, yeah.
Beauchamp.
Yeah.
And I wish you all the best with the book sales. And, you know, we talked about this, possibly a whole series of books.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I've started writing my next one already, actually, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So how can people reach out to you?
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways. They can go to my website and they can, you know, visit my blog. You can go to the contact me page, send an email to me. It's just steve@stevebeauchamp.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn, and that's a little bit harder to find me, but you have to search for me with my middle initial. So if you see the way that I wrote it on the book, that's the easiest way to find me on LinkedIn.
So Steve M.
Yeah, with the M. Yep. And yeah, those are probably the two easiest places to find me. And the book is currently available on the global marketplace on Amazon. So you should be able to get that if you have access to Amazon. So
awesome. Yes. Well, I got my copy from Amazon and it came to me. And yeah, I recommend downloading the workbook, companion workbook as well, and going through that. All right, Steve, thank you so much for your time today. And I look forward to our next conversation on Japanese wisdom.
Indeed, me as well. thank you for the opportunity. It's been amazing.
My pleasure, mate. All right. Bye for now.
Ciao.
This episode was brought to you by the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. To learn more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com.